Over the course of the 13 years of war in Afghanistan, American forces have worked to avoid the disastrous mistakes of the Soviets in the 1980s or of the British in three Anglo-Afghan wars. So, as a strategy, the U.S. has increasingly relied on special operations forces in Afghanistan and elsewhere. RAND Corporation policy analyst Linda Robinson has spent almost 30 years researching conflicts and almost 15 years studying special operations forces, the subject of her new book, 100 Victories, Special Ops and the Future of American Warfare. It's published by Public Affairs, and I'm very pleased that it brings Linda Robinson to our show. Hello.
Hello, I'm delighted to be with you.
Now, last Friday, a Taliban attack on a Kabul cafe killed 21 people, 13 of them Westerners, all of them civilians. You've traveled to Afghanistan repeatedly. Have you been to the Taverna du Liban, the site of the Friday attack?
Yes, I have eaten there many times, and it was a very sad event to read how many people died there. But the Taliban has been attacking choice targets in Kabul for a while.
President Hamid Karzai has warned that his country risks slipping into feudalism. Why feudalism?
Well, it's an interesting choice of words, and I guess I would not be one to say I can always parse the mind of Hamid Karzai. But I think that he is concerned about the future. He's taking kind of an interesting tack toward negotiating with the U.S. and NATO about what to do about Afghanistan's future. But they have elections coming up in April if they don't get postponed. So there's a lot riding on the next few months.
When you've been in Afghanistan, has that been mostly around American military forces?
Yes, I've spent most of my time out in the countryside. I've generally come in either to Kabul or I've also flown directly into Kandahar. But the focus of my research has really been in the rural areas. And as a female foreigner, and particularly in my work observing the special operations forces, there's really no way to do that without going out there and staying with them in these remote villages. So that was my basic approach in researching this last book.
How much did you have to rely on the U.S. military granting you access?
Well, the my first stop when I wanted to undertake this book project, I wrote to General Petraeus, who was then the four-star commander in Afghanistan, and I said, you know, I've been watching this evolving mission in the villages, and I want to write a book about it, but obviously I need to get access to be able to go out there. And he was a little reluctant, but I have done enough research on special operations forces over the recent years that, frankly, they were willing to support the project. And so it went forward, but I did have to gain a commitment that I would be able not only to visit these places, but make repeat visits, because I wanted to be able to see how the situation evolved there over time.
I'm talking with Linda Robinson, whose previous book about U.S. Army Special Forces, Masters of Chaos, was a New York Times bestseller. Her latest is 100 Victories, Special Ops and the Future of American Warfare. It is published by Public Affairs. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. All four branches of the U.S. military have special operations forces. Do you look at all of them in your book, or is your subject more focused?
Well, I certainly had contact with every member of those four services that contribute to the special operations community. My method in where I would go was really governed, though, by where the main insurgent belt was. And so most of my time was spent in four provinces: Kunar, Paktika, Kandahar, and Uruzgan. Uruzgan was a province where the Navy SEALs had assumed control, and most of the teams, the ground-level SOF units there, were also SEALs. in other places, the Army Special Forces, which constitutes about half of the whole community, they were the primary ground units that I was with.
And they're all organized under the United States Special Operations Command, SOCOM, and then divided into different branches of the military, also among regions of the world. Does all that subdivision complicate things?
Well, it sounds very complicated, but it's actually quite a joint community, and they're used to coming together in these mix-and-match combinations. I should also mention, because I don't want to leave out the Air Force Special Ops, and they're very important. Each team has one, it's called a combat controller, and this is a very critical Air Force Special Operations asset. They are the ones that, if need arises, they can communicate with overhead surveillance assets and then call in airstrikes if needed. Although much of what I chronicle in the book were their non-lethal, non-combat missions working with villagers and other Afghan forces.
Well, the image most of us have of Special Operations is probably something out of an Arnold Schwarzenegger movie or maybe Catherine Bigelow's Zero Dark Thirty. How close do these popular representations come to the real thing?
Well, that is certainly an element of what we do, but you are quite right. The popular imagination is captured by the direct action commando raid, and there are such actions in my book, and particularly combined commando actions with Afghans and special operators alongside each other, which is much more difficult to pull off than a unilateral U.S. Raid. But it does, there's a whole toolkit that they have. They do civil affairs, they do psychological operations, and they do a lot of working with both, in this case, civilian volunteers in the villages, but also military units, usually SOF-like units, in with that partner country, in this case, Afghanistan. The two themes that I really tried to address in the book were the maturing of the Special Operations Force. They really started doing some things differently over these last years in Afghanistan. And the other theme is the small footprint approach, which you mentioned earlier. This is why I believe the future is going to involve a continued or even increased use of special operators, because it's a way of using American military power without going into a big war contingency.
Well, didn't
Don... Yeah.
Okay, I'm sorry. Finish.
Yeah. Just, it's obviously an alternative, but given how exhausted and disappointed people are with the big war type of approach.
Didn't Donald Rumsfeld suggest initially that the Afghan war could be handled largely by special forces? So why didn't that work?
Yes, and that's an excellent question, because there's been a lot of ups and downs and a lot of poignant episodes and traumas that are, some of which are encountered in the book. And the Rumsfeld Revolution in Military Affairs and his definition of a small footprint approach really was limited to this use of a small team on the ground to call in airstrikes and conduct largely unilateral commando raids. And that is one tool in the toolkit, but it absolutely is not what the community has realized is the war-winning use of their skills. It's something that may be needed. It may have been overused, and I think certainly was overused in Afghanistan. And this is also, I think, the lesson of Iraq. It's not the numbers of American forces primarily, it's how they're used. And what changed with regard to U.S. special operators in the last few years is they became much more focused on enabling and empowering Afghan civilians and Afghan forces to be able to secure themselves. And that sounds like a very simple thing. You may say, why in the heck weren't you doing that to begin with? But we got very focused on direct action and not on enabling that country to secure itself. So very belatedly now, that has been the primary focus.
And direct action has led to the greatest success claimed for Special Operations Forces to date. I would think anyway, the location and killing of Osama bin Laden. But there's been some controversy over whether the Navy SEALs that killed bin Laden set out to capture or to kill him.
Well, that is certainly...
From what you're saying, I would assume they would have wanted to have captured him.
Well, in all scenarios, it's better to have captured a target, because then you, quite narrowly, you get better intelligence value out of someone who's alive than someone who's dead. But I don't by any means want to diminish the success of that very difficult raid. But as I ascribe my book for Admiral McRaven, who was the commander of that operation, I said, you'll be known publicly for this raid as your historical legacy. But what he's done to mature the community is really, in my view, far more important in the long run, because he understands this powerful effect that you get when you help those country forces be able to secure themselves.
So are we really teaching the Afghan military and police to do their job well? All I hear is terrible reports.
Well, and this is unfortunate, but again, I think the difficulty in people getting out to see some of what has gone on, and the difficulty or the command's reluctance to let people see what's going on, and I think that's just still a legacy of their closed nature. But if you will allow me, I'll just tick off the things that have happened. I've mentioned at several points the volunteer civilians defending their local villages. A small number of special operators dispersed widely in 62 teams at their peak out in multiple villages, raised a total of 25,000, upwards of 25,000 local defenders at the cost of a quarter of what it takes to raise regular Afghan army soldiers. And the police and the army were just simply not getting out to these areas where the insurgents were. There have been problems, and unfortunately, like Wardak province, that did not work at all there, and I do include that in my book. It's a mess. But what people don't realize is the major population and economic corridors of key provinces have been secured through this initiative. And all I can tell you, Leonard, is people haven't reported it because they haven't been able to get out there to look at it, but it has worked. They've also raised the most competent part of the Afghan army is the Afghan Special Operations Forces. They have commandos, they have special forces, and they have a ranger-like unit. They're also building an air wing for them, so they will be sufficient if we can continue the training and advising. And finally, very much less noticed is we had 24 coalition countries contribute special operators, which is their biggest endeavor ever. I mean, the U.S. has never worked alongside so many coalition SOFs.
So most countries have special ops forces?
Yes, I'm talking about our traditional allies like Britain, Australia, New Zealand, Norway, Sweden, but also new countries with new forces like Romania, Lithuania, Slovakia. There were all kinds of countries that wanted to contribute. Poland. Poland's been very active in this regard. So the mission that those coalition special operators took on was to raise 17 provincial response companies. They're basically SWAT-like police entities, police units that are at the provincial level. And in those 17 provinces that are most plagued by the insurgent threat. And they've been working with them not to go out and kill, but to serve warrants and to do police actions. So this has been a very important and not widely covered effort. Also, they have also worked with some Ministry of Interior Kabul-based unit. So there's really been a variety of training and advisory efforts going on. And what's important, and when I say maturing of special operations forces, they finally have managed to stop seesawing back and forth between different approaches. They've applied this training and advising approach now for several years straight, very intensive mentoring. I don't think it's over. I don't know that these units can go. If we pull the plug entirely, will they all be self-sustaining come the end of this year? But there's been a big investment, and from what I've seen, they have become more effective. I think we don't know, frankly, until we see what the follow-on arrangements are going to be. And I think the elections, as I mentioned at the outset, the elections and a successful enough transition from Karzai to his successor, I think, is going to be psychologically probably the most important thing.
I'm talking with Linda Robinson, Senior International Policy Analyst at RAN. Among her previous books is Masters of Chaos, which was a New York Times bestseller, and now 100 Victories, Special Ops and the Future of American Warfare, published by Public Affairs. We'll continue our conversation after we take a little break. Stay with us. We're back with Linda Robinson. Her latest book, 100 Victories, Special Ops and the Future of American Warfare, published by Public Affairs. Linda, there's a Special Operations Forces industry conference each year, and at the 2012 conference, Hillary Clinton said, Special Operations Forces exemplify the ethic of smart power, fast and flexible, constantly adapting, learning new languages and cultures, dedicated to forming partnerships where we can and acting alone when we must. Is that the Obama administration position on the future of special forces?
I think that sums it up pretty well. And that event where she spoke was a gathering of these international soft forces, not just the U.S., but those many countries that I was mentioning. So for some time now, they've been trying to get willing countries to come together and look at how they can apply their, what areas and problems do they want to work together in.
How large or small a force counts as a special op?
Well, thank you for asking that, because it is, most people are shocked to find out how large ours is. Since 9/11, it's about doubled in size and now has 33,000 uniformed special operators. Most countries are actually in the four digits, very small forces. So you can see how 24 countries might come together in Afghanistan and you wouldn't notice, because they don't add up to the kinds of numbers we've put over there.
I'd imagine that much of the think about special operations began after the failure of Operation Eagle Claw, that failed 1980 attempt to rescue American hostages in Iran. Did the various leaders in the military get together and say, we can't do that sort of thing again?
Absolutely. That was the inspiration for this, and Congress really did force and galvanize the formation of the Special Operations Command in order to bring together the services and the Air, the Navy, the Marines, and the Army. Now all routinely operate together. What happened in Desert Storm and also in Grenada in the Operation Urgent Fury is they just simply weren't well prepared. They weren't able to operate and with tragic results. And now, as I mentioned, every command structure has all four elements in them, and the ground teams usually have at least two of the services. So they're really quite, probably more integrated than any other part of the U.S. military.
Because in the past, the military always seems to be caught up in rivalries. And then we have agencies like the CIA and the NSA. Do they have their own special operations divisions?
No. What happens is special operators can get seconded over to different agencies, primarily the CIA.
Because the CIA played a lead role in the operation against bin Laden. Why the CIA instead of the military?
Well, the CIA had control of the operation because it was carried out as a covert operation, and normally the CIA is tagged with that. It isn't the only entity that can lead covert action, but historically, traditionally, that's what's happened. But people have, there's a lot of confusion when you talk about the CIA because, of course, there are CIA analysts and other intelligence community analysts. So those are not paramilitary operatives, but they have been pushed out very aggressively in the last 12 years to work alongside the special operators in helping them analyze intelligence quickly that is being gathered up on the battlefield and also signals intelligence that they're picking up. So that on-the-ground fusion has been really revolutionary, and I think sometimes the intelligence analysts don't get as much credit. And that's, of course, Zero Dark 30 did its bit to give them that credit. But then there's the other element, which CIA has a paramilitary force, and it does do operations. And that is one thing I think we're kind of waiting to see when John Brennan, the current director of the CIA, had his confirmation hearings in the Senate. He indicated that he felt it might be time for the CIA to start re-embracing its traditional analytical mission and de-emphasizing some of the paramilitary aspects. Those will never go away, but I think that rebalancing is one thing that Brennan indicated he felt was in order, because the primary mission of the CIA has always been to do that national strategic intelligence analysis.
The Associated Press reported a year ago that the United States is developing a Special Operations Command North that would cover North America. Is the U.S. government conducting special operations in the U.S., Canada, or Mexico? And would there be constitutional issues with any special operations conducted in the United States?
Yes, my understanding is this new element based at NORTHCOM is really focused on cooperation with Mexico. And this would be, again, in the training advisory type of realm to help Mexican forces contain some of their violent security threats. That I did neglect to mention Canada. Canadian SOF, which is very small but very active, they have been partners with the U.S. In many places, including Afghanistan. They are going to be, I think, a primary partner going forward. A quarter of them speak French, for example, so, and they've been willing to be out in Africa and go different places. So they're more of a partner for other missions. There's no real security threat that would draw the U.S. Into its soil that I'm aware of.
The title of your book comes from Sun Tzu, whom you quote in the book: "To win 100 victories in 100 battles is not the acme of skill. To subdue the enemy without fighting is the acme of skill." So the special ops are really out there to not fight?
Thank you for bringing up the quote behind the book title, because so many people have misinterpreted and saying there's not 100 victories in the book, and there's probably as many failures as victories in the book, because it's part of how people learn. You know, you do things, they don't work, you try to process it and go forward. And I think the traumatic experiences they've been through have been just as important. But it is, I would say, the majority of the time, special operators are out there in these non-lethal capacities. Sometimes they may be supporting combat operations of the country they're in, and sometimes they're alongside them conducting combat. So you can really have a spectrum. But the unilateral use of force in another country is the diminishing mission set. As we leave and Afghanistan and draw down there, there'll be relatively few cases around the world where the U.S. is conducting unilateral special ops raids.
During the Obama presidency, American drone strikes have ignited criticism around the world. Special ops haven't gotten as much news coverage. Is that part of the appeal for the administration? And how are military special operations coordinated with the use of drones or with the new cyber warfare techniques like the Stuxnet virus?
Well, in the case of drones, special operations forces do use drones. Now, there are, and I think it's important because most people assume drones mean armed, and of course there are armed drones. The use of unarmed drones for surveillance is quite ubiquitous now. They have hand-launched drones. You know, it's part of the toolkit on the battlefield. But the really controversial part is the armed drones, and Special Operations Forces and the CIA both use them. The question, and I guess in my view, is they've probably been overused, but the selling feature that the administration has embraced is that you don't put your troops on the ground in harm's way. They're certainly more precise than some technologies in the history of war, but my view has been the political and diplomatic effects of the use of drones in countries where we are not at war can be quite counterproductive. And there's also now, I think, increasingly this issue of copycat, other countries starting to use armed drones in ways that the U.S. might not agree with. And frankly, if our policies aren't pretty strict and well understood and guidelines for their use limited to those most dire and imminent threats to the U.S., I think we have a hard time standing up in the court of world opinion to start arguing for restricted use of drones by countries.
Well, Seymour Hersh and others have reported that the United States has conducted special operations inside Iran, and a listener wonders about reports of possible American covert operations in North Korea. Is the U.S. conducting those sorts of things?
I don't know, and I do know, though, that Iran is one of those countries with armed drones, and they certainly have shot down U.S. Drones. This has appeared in the open press along with the photos. And so there is, I think, in Iran a very good window into the future for this policy debate that's going on. And my interpretation of President Obama's speech back in May at the National Defense University was that he had ordered a movement toward restricted use of drones. And in fact, the worldwide count that various organizations maintain show a reduced number of drone strikes. But I think that's, you know, what is policy? I think it's still somewhat unclear. The circumstances under which the administration considers their use required or desirable. As for North Korea, I cannot either there tell you what, in fact, we may be doing.
In an essay on RAND's website, you warned that, I'm quoting, the U.S. Special Forces face the serious danger of being bogged down in a permanent game of global whack-a-mole, rather than operating as part of deliberate campaigns that can achieve lasting outcomes. What did you mean by a game of whack-a-mole?
Yes, thank you. I did. This is part of my theme about maturing use of special operations forces, because they have historically been used in these very episodic ways, whether in the whack-a-mole fashion, going out to do a direct action raid, being sent out to kill or capture an individual, even trying to take down the leadership structure of a given cell. That approach, these cells have regenerated, and it can turn into a futile exercise. The other way of using them episodically has been to send a team or two teams out to a country to do a 60-day training mission, and then they leave, and they may not be back for a year. And that has very little impact. The way in which they've been able to have real effect and really produce an increased capability on the part of that country is to go there in small numbers and stay, rotating the teams in and out for a period of several years. This has helped and worked in places like the Philippines, in Colombia, some other cases. And again, these aren't the sexy missions, but these are the ones that tend to work and tend to achieve effect over time.
What do the more traditional American military officers tell you about their thoughts of special ops? Are they all happy with this development? It's going to mean that they have less of a role to play, doesn't it?
Well, one of the big experiments undertaken in Afghanistan...
And you have to tell me very quickly, unfortunately. We're running out of time.
Yeah. A number of conventional infantry squads were attached to each special operations team doing this local defense initiative. Some conventional generals hated that. They did not want their infantry battalions split up in that way. But that's a model for the future, that you can have small numbers of both special operations and conventional forces out there doing some of these long-term missions. And I think a lot of people are skeptical about whether this works, but I would just ask people to look at some of these cases of where they've been able to stay for a while.
Linda Robinson's book, 100 Victories, is published by Public Affairs. Thank you so much.